I don't know Leroy. Most of the hosts haven't known the speakers very well. But when I was asked to do this and said that I would be hosting a man named Leroy, I said, okay. And I was told that I probably know who he is because he's a regular at the Atlanta Men's Workshop. And when I heard his name and I heard the Atlanta Men's Workshop, I'm like, okay, well, I've been to nine of these things. And the only face I could put there was his. We happened to be cabin mates out there. And we really didn't have an opportunity to talk because there's 400 people and you just kind of roam around and conversations are real sporadic and just with whoever you cross paths with. You know, there's something real special about when you walk into a room of Alcoholics Anonymous and you know that you're at home. But there's something extra special when you get an opportunity to sit down one-on-one with somebody and actually connect and share some of your experiences because then it becomes more personal. And I had an opportunity to do that with Leroy last night, and I'm really looking forward to hearing his story. So without further ado.
My name's Leroy. I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. And I'd like to thank the God of my understanding for giving me a chance to have a chance. It's because of him and all you people in this room I haven't found it necessary to drink. And for that, I am eternally grateful. Please forgive the props. I left my big book, so I had to download it on my tablet. You know, and, you know, all my stuff is highlighted and paper clipped. And so then I had to write some of the stuff down. So forgive me, because this has been an awesome weekend. I am so blessed to have been part of this. I love the theme. That was another thing that really touched my heart in regards to celebrating the miracle. Oftentimes when I've told my story over the years, I've realized the miracles along the way, and sometimes I don't always get to highlight those. And those are the most important deals. That's what made me stay. If I didn't hear any of you all's miracles, you know, and that you drank like I did, you know, you ended up in some places like I did, but now your life's better. You know, it was those kind of things, what the big book talks about, someone who can share with some depth and weight that can capture your attention and allow you to be able to identify. I want to thank the other speakers. I want to thank Katie and Jennifer, Rennell. You guys had some awesome stories. I mean, that, you know, so funny, because I was listening to Katie and she was talking about how people act in the group conscious. And I was one of those people. I have caused more problems in a group conscious. You know what I mean? You know, and they was like, God, you know, why do you do that? I was like, I don't know. Something just came over me. I had to interject. My sobriety date is September. Before I do that, I'm going to borrow something from a very, very good friend of mine, Paul M. And I know he won't, you know, there's not a whole lot that's original in this program. So I'm going to borrow this from him if you'll just take a minute with me. Breathe in God, breathe in me. Breathe in God, breathe in me. Breathe in God, breathe out Leroy. I heard him say that one time, and it just, so that I can be reminded that, you know, any success that I have is far more his than mine. As I was saying, I was, my sobriety date is September 27th, 1993. I was born in Brooklyn, New York, grew up there till I was about 12, had my first drink at 6, okay, which, listen, the parents had a party. I woke up to watch cartoons. I saw some glasses half full, half empty, and I drank them all. And then I ended up in the hospital at 6. Now, later on, you know, I learned the whole deal. You know, I found a liquor cabinet, and I was, you know, at about, you know, 10 or 11, I wanted to be accepted. I was the only child till about 9. And, you know, I was hanging out with all these people, all these other kids that had sisters and brothers, and they knew each other. And I wanted to be able to fit in. So when I found out the liquor cabinet, I was like, well, maybe if I bring some of this stuff, they'll let me hang out with them. And I wanted to hang out with older kids. I wanted to be hip, slick, and cool. So, you know, I would steal some of the alcohol, put some water in it, that kind of deal, you know. And that's how I kind of started getting to hang out with some of the kids in the neighborhood and, you know, getting somebody to buy us our first real drink that we actually got to purchase, you know, purchase this for us and purchase something for yourself and that deal. And we'd be out on the benches drinking my, you know, first real, you know, social drink was pink champagne. That is crazy, right? So that was the deal. Immediately, the behavior started changing because, you know, I would start to get in trouble in school. I would get suspended, like, every year. And on my report card, it would always be the same deal. Has no self-control. Every report card, you know, because I felt if I was in class, and regardless of whether I was wrong or not, don't embarrass me in front of my classmates. I'm going to let you have it. And that's what I would do. I would let the teacher have it in front of the class. And that's how I would always get in trouble every year at school. By the time I got to high school, I had a situation where I'd gotten into it with a teacher, and she was like, you're not going to pass my class. And it was like one of those units. It was for chorus, but I needed that elective to graduate. But the principal was a good friend of the families, and you know, and I was like, you know, he's going to have to tell me if I'm going to graduate or I'm just not coming no more. Now, this is a week before graduation. So I go in his office. I'm like, look, I need to know if I'm going to graduate. And he's like, just keep coming to school. I was like, are you telling me I'm going to graduate? He said, keep coming to school. So the alcoholic mind, he's not giving me a definitive answer. So I go. Here's the impulse. I go straight to the recruiter and say, hey, I'm ready to join the Navy. You know, and they put me on delayed entry, and I'm already inducted in. I don't show up to school for a week. Principal shows up to my house like, where are you? What's going on? I was like, couldn't tell me I was going to graduate, so I joined the Navy. He's like, are you nuts? He's like, and this is the deal, right? He says, if I would have told you you were going to graduate, you would have went in that lady's class and acted like a fool. And I would have, no doubt about it. I would have walked around strutting. I'm going to graduate, don't matter what you say. So I ended up going into the Navy at 17 years old. And that took the drinking to another level. I mean, you're expected to drink in the Navy. That's your badge of honor. They should give people a little patch, you know, for drinking in the Navy. And I ended up being recruited by one of my cousins, ended up in Virginia Beach, Virginia. He was in Norfolk, so I wanted to hang out with him. And I ended up on an aircraft carrier, the USS Nimitz. It's now decommissioned. And and at that time, it had one of the biggest substance abuse problems. They actually had us on 2020. Having the biggest substance abuse problem at that time. And it just wasn't nothing you couldn't get on the ship. And, you know, just to show you that my alcoholism had no bounds, when we would pull in the port, we would get this idea, you know, we have been on the ship for, you know, about a month or so, you know, so when we get off, if you don't understand why sailors act the way they act, you know, you're on a ship for like 30 days at a time. When you get off, you're going to get off that ship for like one day. You're lucky if you get off twice. You got to make it count, right? And so we would get off the ship and we'd be like, okay, it's about 20 of us. Like, everybody buy a different fifth, and then we're going to put it all together and drink it all together. And then that's how you end up, you know, wrecking towns and getting locked up. Because I know when I got off the ship, one of the first things that I saw was there were these, like, mummy cages made of chicken wire. And they were just lined up. And I was like, what are those for? And one of the guys said, you'll see when we come back tonight. And what would happen, everybody would be so drunk, people are trying to swim back to the ship. The ship is 5 miles off the shore. They're like, I'm going to get there on my own and all that. So they have to put them in these cages and then transport them back to the ship because that's just how drunk we are at that point. It's just crazy. So another deal about, you know, when I went into the Navy was I had already gotten a reputation. I was already in my first year was nothing but going to school. And so I would show up to classes late all the time because I was drinking the night before. And so I would just get all these unauthorized absences. So then finally, I ended up getting so many that I had to have captain's mass. And that wasn't my first captain's mass. The first one, I hit the sentry because I was drunk, which is the military police. He wouldn't let me in my barracks because I was drunk and I punched him. So that was the first time. And then this next time, it was, I ended up being late. And so one of the guys was an Iranian hostage. And they, when he came back, they gave him his command, which happened to be Virginia Beach. And, you know, so he's like, you got to go in front of this guy. He's like going to be gung ho. You know, it's going to be pretty serious for you. So I go. He lowers the boom on me, you know. Extra duty, fines, reduction in rank. I mean, he gives it to me. And then as I'm walking away, I say, you know what? I got to really let this man know who I am. So I turn back around, and I was like, I know you think that, you know, I'm just a knucklehead or a bad sailor, but I just want you to know that's not me. And he's like, you know, Airman Murphy, I appreciate you bringing that to my attention. He said, it's not going to change anything, but I appreciate you bringing that to my attention. So I walk away. So then what happens is before you get on the aircraft carrier, they give you a welcome aboard speech. So you go and you meet your squadron executive officer or whatever. And so there's five of us, and we go in front of them. And he says, you know, this is what's going to happen. You know, this is what we expect out of you. And then he says, okay, you all can go. He said, Airman Murphy, you stay. And I'm like, oh, my God, what did I do? I just got here, right? And he says, I just want you to know I got a very good report from Commander Sherrier on you. I was like, he's like, and I just want you to know that moving forward, if there's ever any problems, you come to me and we'll always see that we can get it resolved. I didn't know how much that meant. One of the things that I know today is that, you know, we talk about, and as a disclaimer, I'm going to say God. I mean, I know it's higher power, God of your understanding. You know, if you're new, please understand it is about a God of your understanding. Please read, you know, chapter to the agnostics and, you know, the appendix in regards to spiritual experience so that you have your own. But, you know, that was the deal of, you know, I saw where God would intervene even when I was drinking, you know, different things. So he says this to me, and the very first thing that happens is that we're supposed to go out. You know, this is my first cruise, and the lady that I was dating throws me a party. And we make a big cooler of PJ. Now, for any of you that don't know what PJ is, we're talking about 191 proof alcohol. You pour it in the cooler, and you throw fruit and Kool-Aid in there, and you drink it. Okay? So, I missed the ship, which is a very big offense. And then they had to fly me to Spain to catch up with it. So when I get there, and they're like, man, you are going to get it. You are in so much trouble. So now the guy that I got to go in front of is my captain. Now, my captain just happens to be the guy that just shot down two of Omar Gaddafi's MiG planes. He's the guy that shot him down. So I got to go in front of him. So I go in front of him, and so I'm hearing the same deal. You know, all these days, 45 days extra duty, 30 days restriction, reduction in rank. And I just got my head down. I'm like, oh, my God, not again. And so the executive officer says, Murphy, why do you got your head down? And I was like, did you just hear everything that they said? He said, did you hear they said suspended, which I didn't know what that meant. He's like, long as you don't get in trouble for 6 months, nothing happens. Now, I can't sit here and tell you that I didn't get in trouble for 6 months. But I didn't get in enough trouble where I had to go back, you know, in front of him. Eventually, because of all of the help I was getting from this executive officer, people were getting a little tired of me. So the executive officer said, look, they're going to keep messing with you until they can give you a dishonorable discharge. He said, I can give you a full package now, general and honorable conditions, and you got all your benefits. So me being the big shot that I am, I said, well, give me a day to think about it. I came back the next morning and be like, I'll take it. And I only ended up doing 18 months in the military, and I came out with a full benefits package. Now, one of the things that did happen, though, he did tell me, he said, now, if you take this, don't ever try to get back in. And I don't understand what I didn't understand what he meant by that, right? So what happens is that they give me the worst reenlistment code you could ever give anybody. I mean, I don't care what kind of war breaks out, I'm the last person they're going to take, okay? On my discharge paper, when it says reason for discharge, it says convenience of the Navy. So now I'm off and I'm back out here on my own. And now what's happening is I'm getting involved with some other things outside of alcohol, and we're going to keep it confined to alcohol, but my bottom involves some other things that speeded up my process a little bit. And so the deal is, I end up, you know, going back to stay with my dad, which that was a strained relationship because we ended up, parting ways. My mom and my little sister and us ended up going back to North Carolina, where they're from, in Wilmington, North Carolina. And it was one of those deals, you all go to North Carolina, I'll be there directly, and he never showed up. So now I got this issue with not having a dad around. Now I got this issue that I'm going to seek out other men in the street to teach me how to be a man. And what it was really about was other men teaching me how to drink, party, and be with women. And, of course, I probably wasn't getting the best advice, okay? So that's what it started. You know, one of my mom had a girlfriend that she grew up with as kids, and I immediately latched on to her older son. You know, he was a few years older than me, and he started teaching me how to drink. And, you know, teaching me how to drink was, look, we're going to go steal some MD-2020 because we don't really have the money and drink this, and this is how we're going to do our deal. I mean, probably from 12 all the way through, you know, going into the Navy, we were already drinking Richard's Wild Irish Rose, Thunderbird, Roma Rocket, you know, all this stuff here. You know, we were already drinking this stuff, you know, on a regular basis. And one of the things that tickles me is he used to always be like, man, this Richard's Wild Irish Rose, man, is rough. He was like, look, you just got to take a lemon right afterwards and, you know, and squeeze it, you know, and the tape won't taste so bad. It didn't do much for me. So we're doing this deal, and I'm getting this misadvice at the time. But, again, I want to fit in. You know, I want to be part of. You know, and at this point, without a male figure in my life, and my mom's doing the best she can. She's working, you know, day and night, you know, and trying to take care of, you know, two kids. And it was tough for her. And so the more I drank, the more in trouble I got, you know, those kind of things. So that's what was happening leading up to getting out of the Navy. When I got out of the Navy, I went to go stay with my dad in New York. So I go back up there, and I get involved in some other things, and he has to put me out. And I'm homeless. I mean, he literally put me out and told me to go to a shelter. And I did. I worked the shelter system when I could. There were times when I would be out drinking and partying, and, you know, you had to be back to the shelter at a certain time. And if you didn't make it, you didn't have a bed. And so then I would have to live on the trains. And I would ride the trains back and forth all night long, you know, until a cop made me leave and go to another train. There's times when I slept in Central Park. I even had the nerve to try, because you see it on TV, they sleep in Central Park and put the paper over them. It doesn't work, right? So I had done those deals, you know, and living off the land, which basically eating out of the trash can and drinking water from the fire hydrant. Eventually, I, started doing some vending, street vending. And because I was a veteran, I was able to get the license very quickly, and then other people would hire you to sell their merchandise. And you get paid pretty good money, about $200 a day. Did that deal to the point to, you know, Now my alcoholism was just totally out of control. So I tried to go into treatment and went to a VA hospital in Northport, Long Island. And I go in there, and this is during the time you got to talk real bad about yourself, like, you know, I'm just a piece of crap, da 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 da. And so, you know, I do this, and so I tell them this deal about, yeah, I work for these people, they pay me $200 a day, you know, and, you know, I just show up the next day, and that's what they do, you know. And they say, you never stole the money? I was like, why would I do that? They're giving me $200 a day. And the next thing I know, the director says, you know what, I'm going to have to let you go. I was like, what do you mean? He's like, you really don't have a problem. I'm like, I do, I got a problem. You know, and I mean, they kicked me out of the treatment center because they thought I was manageable, which it's not too far out of the pot, because as alcoholics, there's a certain period in our time where, you know, we're kind of functional. After, you know, it takes a while to get to that other place, but, you know, we have that little brief, you know, we have our ways of doing things and getting through things. So I was back out on the street. Eventually, the guys that I was working for, I was getting so out of control, they couldn't handle me anymore. And I was working for some guys that were like, you know, the people that we read about, you know, overseas that, you know, are part of the militia. And I must have said or done some things that made one of them want to choke me out, you know. And he could look in my eyes that I didn't even care at this point. That's where I was in my alcoholism. Like, if you're going to take me out, take me out. And me and his brother were real close, and his brother said, you know, what's wrong with you? I said, I just want to go home. And I was telling him about North Carolina. So he said, you want to go home? And he took me to the Port Authority, put me on a bus, and they even called my mom to make sure that I got there okay. You know, again, that's just a part of God already showing up in my life. You know, when I was out there drinking in New York, I was ending up with some folks that were, like, really out there. And they could have took me out of any day, and it never happened. I've had gun put to my head. Could have went off. Never happened. So, you know, and then I was raised in the church. And although it was my parents, you know, and my family's God, I understood that there was one for me. I just knew I didn't use him effectively. It was always, get me out of this one. I need you now when I'm at, you know, right at the bottom of whatever I'm doing, now I need your help. So I was always really pimping God, is what it was going on. I wasn't, you know, I wasn't using him the way you should use someone that's supposed to be all powerful and all knowing and all that neat stuff. So at this point, you know, I'm back in North Carolina, getting back with my drinking buddies, you know, and then I end up, I used to hang out in, you know, North Carolina, we have those, like, you know, you can't drink no more after about 1 or 2 o'clock in clubs or whatever. So you have to go to the shot house, the bootleg house, you know, and they make it a real party. They feed you and all that neat stuff, you know, and the drinks are cheap, you know, and, you know, the men and women are pretty cheap too. So you just hang out and do what you do. And, that's what I did for a while. And then, I met a guy from Atlanta, and he said, look, man, you know, he has this nice condo, on the beach. And he says, look, man, you got a pretty good gift to gab. He's like, come on down to my condo, you know. And, you know, and then I knew the lady he was dating was a good friend of mine I grew up with. And so we're there, and he's, you know, he's talking all this talk. And he's like, man, I got guys down in Atlanta that talk like you talk. They're making thousands of dollars a week. And I'm like, yeah. I want to keep drinking your liquor and partying is what I'm saying in my mind. So then he shoots me this deal. He says, I'll tell you what. He says, I'm so confident that you could do this. He said, I'll fly you to Atlanta, and if you can't do it, I'll fly you back home. And sure enough, he flew me here to Atlanta. What it turned out is that he had a boiler room, telemarketing boiler room, and you told lies on the phone, and they paid you thousands of dollars. I lied quite well. So my first week, I made $1,500 in 1989, and I've never left Atlanta since. You know, that was a tough deal, because once I got into that business, I was just a step below Wolf of Wall Street, if any of you have seen that, okay? I'm just telling you, this is the kind of world I was in. And so it was a tough deal. And the only thing that started stopping me was ending up, 'cause now, 1 minute I'm homeless from my drinking and partying. And the next minute, you know, I'm like, I have all this money and I can pretty much do whatever I want. But what would happen is I would get locked up. That's where it really begins for me. Okay? So the first time I got locked up, they let me go on my own reconnaissance. Pretty cool. Yeah, that's pretty good. The second time I got locked up, they kept me for a little bit, for about a few weeks. The third time I got locked up, they kept me for a little over a month. And I had this probation officer. And this probation officer, and I'm going to make sure I'm careful not to blow her anonymity this time. She's not a probation officer anymore. But she was truly my shero. She did not play with me. She didn't like me at first because, you know, I would come with my money for my fines and be like, here's the money for the fine, but I could never stay, I could never give a clean drug test, you know, and I wasn't supposed to be drinking either. So she said, you know, you come here with your money and all of this stuff here. And so I mess around, and this next time that I got locked up, the only way I could get out is, number one, I had to take this assessment. And I remember, you know, because the guy that I was working for was like this telemarketing kingpin. So, look, I was listening to some people talk about it last night. I was kind of prostituting myself out. It took me a while to get what was going on because he'd be like, you know, it was like, okay, he's locked up and he's not making me any money. I got to get him out. You know, and so he would get me out of it. He's like, send this expensive lawyer. And he's like, look, this is what you got to do. You got to answer these questions like you're a real alcoholic. You know, he says, it's going to take you about 3 hours, but just take your time. I answered that thing in about 45 minutes, you know, and do that deal and go in front of the judge. So the judge, like, you know, will them go to this outpatient treatment program. And I was supposed to show up. They let me out on a Friday. I was supposed to go straight to the program. Of course, I didn't do that. I did this deal. You know, me and my ex-wife at the time, now that was my drinking buddy. So she was in New York with our 1-year-old at the time. You know, so while all this was happening, I had already done an everything must go sale at our house, so she couldn't come back home. There was nothing there. So at this point, I end up and, I show up, you know, a couple of days later to the treatment program. And so they have the group, and it's like, you know, so, well, you know, everybody's going around, and they're sharing about different stuff. And then, you know, I share, and it's like, so, you know, Leroy, you were supposed to show up here on Friday. What happened? And I was like, well, you know, I had been locked up for a while, and I needed to get with a woman, and da-da-da-da-da-da, and that's what happened. And one of the guys said, and you didn't drink or do it or use or anything? I was like, nah. You know, so everybody's sharing. I'm starting to feel guilty. So then I raise my hand up. I said, oh, I use. And they're like, oh, we know. And so then this was the turning point for me. Not so much that I wanted to consider recovery, but I just didn't want to go back to jail. And the guy's like, well, the judge told me that if Leroy didn't, you know, adhere to, you know, the rules of this program, that I was supposed to bring him back. He said, so I'm going to leave it to the group. So I'm thinking, they're one of me. What would they possibly say? And the first guy says, F him. If he ain't serious about his recovery, send his behind back. And I was like, oh, my God. And so now I'm really fearful because I don't want to go back to jail. And this one guy who was the house manager that, you know, the apartment that we were, that was considered our halfway house, he said, well, I think we should give him a chance and at least see how he does. And so that's when they started having us on the weekends. Like during the week after work, I'd have to show up from like, you know, 6 to 9 in their program. And, you know, we'd have our group and education about, you know, our alcoholism and all that kind of stuff. And then we'd all go back to the halfway house together. And then on the weekends, we had to go to mandatory meetings. That's how I ended up at the Triangle Men's Club, and I met Mike. And so as some of you have probably heard Mike say, I was a very different person when I showed up there at that first Triangle Men's meeting. And I had some choice language. Every other word was a cuss word. And I was very angry because now I can't drink. And I got all these feelings happening. And I didn't know about how to share in a general way yet. So I would share and I would just go off, and they would take bets that this guy's not going to make it. You know, it's like, this is just not going to make it. And I'm very, very grateful to this day, the love, patience, and tolerance they showed me, because they didn't kick me out like some of the places that I had been in when I was drinking. They really did kind of love me till I could love myself. They displayed that. And so I hung around. And then I remember one day a gentleman named Hank was sharing. And he shared what he caught my attention. He said, you know, he had been doing this and he had been doing that when he was drinking and ending up here and ending up there. And he said, but today my life is so different and I have peace. The word peace caught my attention because I had not had peace for a long time. I had not had peace for a long time. And I think it may have been Jennifer that said this. What I was clear about, being an alcoholic, completely clear. I could not stop. That was my thing. I could not stop. No matter what I did, I could not stop. That's what I wanted to be able to do. And once I saw that I couldn't stop, I said, I'm just going to drink into oblivion. You know what I mean? I didn't have enough guts to kill myself. So I said, I'll drink myself to death. And when I heard him talk about peace, that caught my attention enough where I said, you know, there's no way I would ever get this program if I listened to Leroy. Because I was a con artist. That's why I did so well in the whole telemarketing deal. So I knew I couldn't listen to me anymore. And so I said, you know what? Again, I'm not convinced about no longer being an alcoholic. What I'm convinced about is I'm on probation. I don't want to go back to jail. So here's the deal. We go ahead and do this deal they're talking about. You'll gain a little weight. You'll save a little money. Your 9-month probation will be up. You're out of here. That was the plan. But I messed around and I asked this guy, you know, to temporarily sponsor me. And I was like, I've been hearing about these steps. How soon do I work the steps? He said, how soon do you want to get well? I said, okay. And so we started working the steps. And like I said, didn't really have a problem with, you know, coming to believe in a power greater than myself. You know, I kind of had that. I just had to learn how to be able to utilize God in the right way. And the third step helped me with that. You know, I ended up having another sponsor, because this sponsor took me to the fourth step. It was so funny because when I got to the fourth step, you know, I would do the procrastination deal. You know, take my little time and do stuff. And so I would call him, like, this is going on, that's going on. He would listen, and he would be like, so, did you do your fourth step? I was like, no. And so every time I would call him to kind of, you know, moan and, you know, and all of that stuff about what was going on, he would be like, did you do your fourth step? So after a while, I'm sick of this. So if something's going on, I'm like, you know what, I'm not calling him. I guess I'll go work on this fourth step. Right? And that's how I got through the fourth step. It took me a while to do it, but it came to a point that I started realizing that a lot of the problems that I was still having was a result of me not doing it. And I was like, if I want to feel better, if I want to get better, I got to start doing this. So I remember getting with a friend of mine, and that was in the program too, and he was having issues with his fourth step, and we said, look, let's go to the library, you know, and this is the library downtown was open late. So we're going to go downtown to the library, we're going to finish it up, you know, we're not going to leave till we finish. And that's what we did. We went down to the library and we finished the fourth step. I ended up meeting another guy. I used to go to the Clarkston group, and I ended up meeting another guy who I kind of connected with that took me through my fifth, sixth, and seventh step, and, you know, and we went through that, and I was able to share with him, and, you know, the deep, dark secret thinking, you know, surely nobody's done this, and he shared some things that made mine look real small, and he was, he's the one that taught me about all the answers being in the big book. To the extent, now, I'm not this guy, I have to have my book highlighted, all that, he would be like, we're on the phone. We rarely met, only when we saw each other in a meeting. And he would be like, Leroy, I'd be like, this is going on. He's like, go get your big book. He said, look down, page such and such, paragraph such and such reading. And whatever he would tell me to read, it would be the answer to my problem. And that amazed me. I'm like, this is for real. This, you know, this deal with the book being able to provide you with solutions to the answer to my problem. So that was the deal. That's what we went through. Anything that I went through, he would tell me to do that. And so now here it is, you know, got about a year doing the deal. You know, my ex-wife at the time, she's still drinking. And the behavior's rampant and out of control. And I eventually have to get custody of my children and have her removed from the home. Real tough deal. Plus, you know, I wasn't all that ready. I had a 2-year-old and a 6-year-old at the time. I was not ready for that responsibility in my mind. You know, I mean, I saw my mom do it, but I was like, you know, women have this innate deal, you know, to kind of step in and like, this is what I got to do for my kids. You know, I got to be honest, us men don't have it. We can get there, but we just don't have it right off the bat like that. And so that was the deal. And I remember saying to my sponsor, like, why me? He said, why not you? He said, if nothing else, to make sure you help the next guy that has to go through this. So I went through the whole deal and custody and having her put out, and it was real ugly and sad. Then I had to, you know, let our house go, and I had to downsize. And now I'm still doing this telemarketing deal. This is how I'm supporting. I paid for my own treatment doing this telemarketing stuff. But here's the deal about working the steps. I don't care how you come into this program and what your motives are. If you work the steps, they will work in spite of you. Doesn't matter that you don't want to be here. Work the steps and something's going to happen. And so what was happening for me is I'm doing this telemarketing stuff. I'm lying on the phone, stealing from people. And now it doesn't feel comfortable anymore. I mean, in fact, it feels horrible. I'm at the point at this one day, because everybody I work with drinks, they party. And now I'm at this point like, the only way I'm going to be able to keep doing this is I'm going to have to drink. And so I pray to God. First I had to put my desk up to a wall, where I didn't have to face anybody. And I pray one day. And then one day, this guy comes and sits behind me. So I'm reading my big book. So, you know, I'm new in the program, so he says, so you're a friend of Bill's. Got no clue what that means, right? I was like, friend of who? He's like, the big book. I was like, oh, Bill W. Oh, I got it, right? And he says, hi, my name's Tyrone. I got 7 years. That's the miracles that I'm talking about. And it was like, I was able to connect with him every day during that time that I'm having to do this. And to the point that I realized, I can no longer do this and transition out of it. I mean, I can't stop. I need to pay for this treatment. This treatment is helping me. So I transition out of it. And now I'm moving along. I'm taking care of my kids. All kinds of, I'm seeking help. I mean, the people in the program, of course, were helping me. I remember my sponsor telling me, he said, listen, I'm going to be honest with you. He said, probably the best support you're going to get for you and your kids is the church. See, because our book talks about see where religious people are right. And the fact was, I know you all loved me. I know you all would do anything in the world for me. But I really needed some help with these kids. And the deal is, you know, we talk about it. You know, you don't want to become this big spiritual giant and your kids are left with like, we don't know anything about those principles you're talking about. I had to provide them with something spiritual that they could latch onto. And at the same time, I ended up finding a church that I'm a member of to this day for almost 20 plus years, you know, that loved on us. They just loved on us. Didn't try to shove anything down our throat. I mean, I think the first time we showed up at the church, a lady walked by and she just stuck a $20 bill in my hand. She said, you and your kids go out and have dinner today. After the church, everybody would just hug us. You know, my kids latched on to all kind of activities and things of that nature. I continued to come to Alcoholics Anonymous because I'm clear that the church is to save my soul and AA is to save my butt. I'm not confused. You know, in the process of working these steps, another thing that happened is I ended up gradually stopped cursing. Now, let me tell you how it happened. One day I was at a co-ed meeting, and I'm doing my deal, cursing like crazy. And it was this big guy. His name was Joe Lewis. I didn't mean for your last name, sorry. All right? Big guy. He's passed on to that meeting in the sky. And he came, and he's about six. He got to be about 6'8". He pulled me out to the side. He said, come here, young man. He said, I don't got to listen to that language you're talking about. You don't have to talk like that. What's wrong with you? And, you know, he gave me the what for. And over time, I decided I didn't want to do that anymore. And I kind of stopped. Now, I'm not telling you I don't have some interjecting moments that get by, because I do. So that started happening for me, okay? I'm raising my kids, and in the process of raising my kids, so I got to get us an apartment. So this is the deal. I got to get an apartment. And so when I get this apartment, this is before me and my ex-wife split up. This is like they're still in New York. I did everything must go sale, so there's no longer a house or apartment. So I've been in treatment now 6 months. I'm getting out, and I got to get a place for them to stay. So I'm going to these apartments. I don't have a car or anything, so I'm catching a cab to different apartments I picked out. And so when I go for the apartment, I always want to come up with a story because I got that con thing going still. And I'd be like, they'd be like, so why is your credit like this? Oh, this, that, and the other, you know. And they'd be like, no, we can't rent to you. So I went through two of these where I got turned down for an apartment. So I'm down to the last one, which is nicer than any of the other ones that I just got turned down from. And I was like, and I sat in the back of the cab and I prayed. I said, okay, God, I said, this next one that I go to, if it's what you want me to have, then I'll have it. And if not, you'll have something better. Because I had the sponsor that would tell me, he doesn't say no. He says, not now. I've got something better. So then I thought, okay, that's the deal. And I go in there, and now I'm going to be completely honest. So I go in there, and I say to the lady, I said, look, I just got out of treatment. I need a safe place for me and my kids, you know, my wife, and I'm willing to pay, you know, extra month security if I have to, because I'm a recovering alcoholic. And she said, well, if you hadn't said what you just said, I'd be turning you down too. She said, but I'm a recovering alcoholic. You got the apartment. You got to pay nothing extra. Another miracle. These were the kind of things that were happening for me early on, you know. So then I get that deal. You know, we go through. I'm trying to raise my kids. And now I end up, you know, I'm starting to take care of my body, go to the doctor every year to get my physical. And I go to get a physical this one day. And then he tells me, I don't know, I'm seeing some things in your, you know, regarding your kidneys that don't look good. So what I end up finding out is I have kidney disease. And I have it to the point that my kidneys are failing. And eventually they tell me, look, bottom line is, now, you're down to about 10% and you're going to have to go, well, before that I was getting the HMO shuffle. They really wouldn't tell me what was going on, how bad it was. And so my mom was having some surgery because my mom had moved here to help me with the kids. And she was having some surgery. So before she was going into surgery, I met this anesthesiologist that was, you know, preparing her to go under. And we're talking and having conversations, and my kidney disease comes up. And, you know, he says, yeah, you know, I got a little issue with my kidneys, and eventually I'm going to have to get that addressed. And I'm saying, look, this guy's a doctor. Tell him about getting his kidneys addressed. Let me ask him who he would use. And so I said, well, who would you use? And then he gives me this doctor's name. He said, that's the only guy that would let work on me with my kidneys. So, you know, now I'm coming to this point where I realize that I'm getting to that point where things are failing. So I go to this doctor he's telling me about. When I go to this doctor he's telling me about, the doctor tells me, okay, I was like, look, I need somebody to give it to me straight because nobody won't give me any real answers. He said, well, I'm going to give it to you. He said, you're at 10% function. Get ready for dialysis. So then that's what I had to do. I was going to lose total function of my kidneys, and I had to get ready for dialysis while I had these two children I was taking care of. So I start doing what he tells me to do. And he tells me, now look, there's this home dialysis thing that you can do. You can do your own dialysis. You're not going to have to go to a clinic and be hooked up to a machine if you do this right, you know. And so I'm like, man, that sounds like a lot, right? And so he's sending me to this training to do this. And as I'm walking to the training, so they have the home dialysis clinic, and then they have the dialysis clinic where they hook up to the machine, and a guy is standing out there. He's like, man, you getting ready to do that home dialysis? That thing like that killed me, right? But I'm looking at him, and there's something apparently different about him. I can tell he's drinking. And so when I see that, I'd be like, in my mind, I'm like, but I'm not going to do it like you. And I walk in there, right? Because this program taught me about following instructions. So I went in there, they told me what to do. And four times a day, I had to do exchanges where I did my own dialysis for 3.5 years. I did that. I was afforded the opportunity to get a job working with the bank, that I was able to get an apartment less than a mile from the bank. And in the morning, I would do it. I would go home for lunch and do it. I'd come home and do it. And then I'd do it before I go to bed. And I did every. And this type of dialysis is known for people getting infection. I never got infection once out of the 3.5 years. I never had a problem out of where I ended up getting a hernia. And I had to go into the hospital. And they were telling me they were about to put me under to get this repaired, but I was coming down with some kind of fever. I wasn't feeling too good. And so I'm telling this nurse, but she's not paying me any attention. So they're wheeling, they got me down there ready to go into surgery. And who comes walking up this, who comes walking down the hall? The anesthesiologist that told me about the kidney. He's like, hey man, how you doing? I was like, not so good. I'm not feeling so. He said, you're not what? He said, hold on. He stopped the surgery, had the nurse removed, you know, and made sure I was okay. Now, here's the real miracle. This particular doctor, I was sponsoring a guy. And, you know, in recovery, you started doing some fun things. So we would have fight parties to a guy's house that was in recovery. So at this fight party one night, I invite my sponsee. Who does he walk in the door with? The anesthesiologist. These are the kind of miracles. You can't make this up. You can't make this up, you know? And this is the kind of stuff that was happening for me. You know, then the deal is I'm going to the Rock, and we're doing the workshop stuff. We're working on ourselves. And we would hear all these different speakers. So this one time I heard this speaker. His name is Kip C. And he told this story about his daughter getting hit by a car and being killed. And the guy went to jail. And as a result of his recovery, he started going to visit the guy to help him. As a result of his recovery, when the guy got out of jail, he gave him a place to stay. This is the guy that backed into his daughter and killed her, you know, in the driveway. So I heard this story. So couple of years later, or maybe a year later, I ended up, you know, my family had like a little mini family reunion, and the grandmothers wanted to hang out with their granddaughters. So my daughter at this time, she's 9, my youngest. And, you know, I take my son, you know, and my nephew, and we come back to Atlanta. They're in Wilmington, and they're going to drive to Charlotte, North Carolina. And on their way driving to Charlotte, North Carolina, an 18-wheeler drives them off the road. So I lose an aunt, my daughter, another cousin her age. We lose the 3 of them. You know, my mom survived, my niece survived, another aunt survived, and another niece survived. So that was a tough deal. And, you know, here's where intuitiveness comes in. Because when I first got the call, you know, my aunt, she's frantic. She says, been a bad accident. We don't know what happened. It's just bad, you know. And so I immediately, start praying. And I'm in my car and I'm praying and, you know, please God this, please God that. And then somebody says to the effect that there are some fatalities, but they don't know who. So now I'm automatically going into grieving mode, even though I don't know who it is. I'm starting to do some bargaining. I'm like, God, please, you know, save my daughter, da, 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 da. So I immediately end up calling a couple of guys in the program. I'm like, look, I need you, and I need you now. I said, I'm going home. So by the time I get home, they're there. Once they get there, as soon as they walk through the door, I get a call, and it's one of my other cousins, and she says it as nice as she can. You know, they said there are only X number of survivors, and she just says the name of the people that survived. And I was like, but she's like, there's only these survivors. These are the people that survived. And I immediately start bawling. And my two friends, they stand there and they just let me. And then I pop up and I said, I need two things. And they're like, oh, God, what is he going to say? And I said, because I had stopped smoking for some years. I said, I need a cigarette and a meeting. That's the intuitiveness. I knew that I needed to call them. I knew I needed a meeting. It was like automatic. And before the night was out, my house was filled with my home group. It's real important if you're new in this program or if you don't have a home group. First of all, if you don't have a home group, you're homeless. Okay? And then if you don't feel your home group is the greatest home group in the world, you need another home group. Because those are the ones that held me up through that process. Because now I got to deal with her mom, who's not in recovery, and their family, you know, and something just kicked in during that time where I was able to make these funeral arrangements and deal, you know, and walk through that process. And if it had not been for me hearing, so here's the deal. People would ask me to start, you know, they would ask me to start, you know, coming to a grief an acceptance workshop, you know, facilitate, share, whatever. That's what was helping me. Me being able to talk about it. Had I had this stayed, I could have went into a real dark place. But people started asking me to kind of share my experience, strength, and hope. And that's where it started really, just like the program, like we talk about. And in that process, you know, in the process of doing that, you know, I got so much relief. And then I remember, you know, people would ask me, like, so are you angry? Because the guy that hit them, he kept going. And so they said, so, I mean, how are you feeling about that? Here's where the program again kicks in. I said, there's only one or two things that could have happened. Either number one, he hit them and didn't know he hit them. Or number two, he hit them and he was too afraid to stop. The reason I could say that, because I heard stories like ours where we did some things and we didn't get what we deserved. Thank God we didn't get what we deserved. You know what I mean? That's what helped me. That's what got me. You know, and I could understand that. And I swear to you to this day, if I ran into this guy in a meeting and he admitted I was the one, I'm telling you right now, I'd hug him. Because I know that's a heavy weight to carry. We've carried some things like that. We could have killed some people, and some of us have. So I understood that. So I was able to walk through that deal. In that process, when I was doing the grieving piece, you know, and bargaining, one of the things I said in the car, I said, you know, I knew God kind of had a calling on my life about some things that he wanted me to do. And I'd been, you know, while I'm drinking, trying to do none of that, God, right? But now I'm not drinking. I've worked some steps. I'm practicing some principles. And it's changed me. And so when I was doing that bargaining, I said, God, if you're to save my daughter, if you want me to minister across this land, I promise to you I'll do it. So during the funeral, one of my daughter's teachers got up to speak on our behalf. And my daughter's name was Shakira. And I named her Shakira because I found it in a book because it's Arabic and it means thankful. And she said, the one thing I know is that Shakira was truly saved because she used to come to school and she used to talk to the other kids about God. I cannot tell you. How much that helped me. That helped me. You know, my son got up there and spoke about the love of his daughter. I mean, of his sister. So I saw God in action. I saw him in action in my life. And that helped me so much to get through that. You know, eventually, you know, I'm still processing through this. And eventually I have to answer that call that I promised God because he did what I asked him to do. He saved my daughter. And so one night I was watching a Major League Baseball player receive an award, and he thanked God and his teammates. He said, it's about them, not about me. And then I heard God speaking to my spirit, that's what I want you to do with your experience and strength and hope. I want you to speak and help others. So I accepted becoming a minister at my church. I was ordained as a minister in 2013. You know, and I had to tell, you know, I went to my pastor, like, look, you already know who I am, okay? All right, you know I'm an alcoholic and I do some things. I'm not going to be one of these stuffy kind of preachers, any of that kind of stuff. You know, he's like, no. He's like, I want you to be exactly who God has you being. You know, because there's a part in the big, big book that says wherever you're called, that's where your ministry is. So I knew my ministry was going to be continue to help alcoholics. And eventually, through not being comfortable in sales, and, you know, I have to give another disclaimer because I shared in a meeting about how sales was giving me problems and all that, and people that were salesmen got offended. They don't understand the kind of sales I'm talking about. So it got to a point that it didn't matter. I was in the mortgage business. I did other kind of sales that are acceptable and can be done a certain way, but I no longer had the spirit to really, you know, and I don't want to offend those salespeople, you know, because I did it, you know. I have a little sense of manipulation, you know, a little sense of trying to convince people that they need this, you know, and directing them where I want them to go with it. But God just saw me, chose to have me use it in a different way. Not that I sell, you know, God, but I do present his principles. And the one thing I learned, the sponsor that I have now, I had to give me a sponsor that understood what I was doing with ministry and still being in the program. And he said, Leroy, I find no conflict with the two. He said, they're two different things, but they work together. And they do. To the point, you know, whenever I come to my pastor and I say, look, I want to start a meeting. He said, go ahead, no problem. He said, I know a lot of people who need it. he said, for real, you know. So he's in complete favor of anything that I have to do pertaining to recovery. God has blessed me also to be able to work in the realm of recovery, where now I have a job that allows me to work with other alcoholics and get paid for it. And I can't tell you how much of a relief that is. Then my next miracle, you know, as I was going through the steps and I get to step six and we talk about the reservations, you know, talk about, you know, not being able to have the reservations, you know, and how, you know, we could start working on the small stuff and put some of that back stuff on the back burner and how it can come back and bite us in the butt if we do. And I'm kind of paraphrasing. And so mine was lust. I was like, well, if I give up my lust, that's like taking away from my libido. I don't want to lose that. You know, I want that. It's good stuff, right? So I go on, and so eventually my lust is getting the best of me. It's literally almost like alcoholism. It was like it got to a point where I was numb. I was going through the motions, and I remember a girl saying to me one time, she said, you're not going to hurt me, are you? Or use me. She said, because that's what other men do. I'm like, oh, my God. You know, because that's what I did. And I remember being in so much pain one night. I got on my knees. I said, okay, God, I'm ready. Take this lust from me. Be careful what you say when you're praying. Like, take this lust from me. I don't care if I have to be celibate for 5 years. And I ended up being celibate for 3.5. But it was necessary for where he was taking me. And that's how he led me to my beautiful wife over there. We were, you know, at a picnic, and you know, at the time she came with a friend of mine, was dating a friend of hers, and she came with them, and I saw her sitting there, and I said, she's pretty nice looking. She must be here with some guy. And I was looking for, you know, the man, and she was just sitting alone. And she, you know, she seemed a little kind of sad and to herself. And I was like, you know, I sat next to her, and she started sharing about the fact that she had just lost her mother. And then she had lost her husband a few years prior to that. So she was really grieving. And I had gone through the grieving process, and I just started sharing with her in regards to the grieving process. And there were some other guys in my home group that were in the tent with us, and they're watching us communicate. So then she leaves, and they're all looking at me all stupid, you know, like, I'm like, why y'all looking at me? It's like, you didn't get it. We saw the connection. You didn't see it, you know. So they talked me into trying to get her number. And I asked in an appropriate way about getting a number. And just a real quick note about the whole celibacy piece, you know, again, I heard someone share. I was at Rock Eagle. This guy shares about how when he was in the when he got his sponsor and he had gotten a year clean, he was ready to start dating. But he told the sponsor, I really don't know how to date. He says, well, he says, you go, you ask somebody out for a date. He said, they say yes. You go to pick him up. Don't try to kiss her. He says, open the door for her, wait till she gets in, you know, take her on a date, bring her back home, don't try to kiss her, and then you see if she lets you take her out another date. So he tells this story, and he tells this story how they did this, and they got close, and then they got to that place where they wanted to get hot and heavy, you know, and they had been dating for a while the right way, and he said they, you know, they were about to go ahead in this, you know, they were going to get married, but they were going to have sex first. And he said they decided at that point, you know what? We've gone this far. Why don't we just go ahead and wait it out and do it the right way? And I caught that message. So when I met her, we probably talked on the phone. Now, this is no lie. We probably talked on the phone for at least 2 to 3 hours a night for 30 days. Okay, so we just spent a lot of time as far as getting to know one another and revealing some things. So then it's about to get hot and heavy. And then I say, first of all, because of my belief system, I got my 18-year-old son staying with me. I don't want to send the wrong message. I'm like, look, we're not going to be able to shag. You know, we're going to, you know, I got standards now, Ronell. We're not going to be able to do this, okay? And she said, no, we're not going to be able to do this. And so we make the decision to get married. We get married in 90 days. I don't suggest that that's how you do it. But we had worked out most of the stuff except for the cohabitation stuff. Because then, you know, as soon as I say, you know, we're going to need to get married, she comes to my apartment and she starts throwing stuff away. I'm like, what are you doing? Oh, we don't need this. I'm bringing my stuff. This has got to go. I'm like, you know, my God, you know. But, you know, I know that God chose her for me. I know that God, you know, brought us together. You know, we're both in recovery. We both work in recovery. We have the passion of helping people. It's just been, you know, we have, her and I have a saying, you know, we're not perfect, but we're perfect for each other. And we are. You know, it's never a perfect situation, but there's not anyone else I'd rather be on this journey with. There's not any other place I'd rather trust, you know, me with than with you guys. Because the one thing that was real cool was at my daughter's funeral, I got this big church. And on one side, I got my church family. And on the other side, I had my Alcoholics Anonymous family. And they were all together supporting and loving me. So I'm telling you, if you're new to this program, if you're not new to this program, you know, keep doing the deal, because this is the part, and I'm going to leave you with this. When trouble comes, not if, but when, you need to have a support system. It talks about it in the 10th step when it says the acid test and the 12 and 12. to be able to work under good purpose under all conditions. Because some conditions will come. And, you know, there's no other process that I know that brings you through, because it was this process that brought me back to my God and taught me to use him effectively. You know, and I'm able to really love God, love you guys. And I'm just glad to be part of this deal. I appreciate you all inviting me, and I appreciate you all 12-stepping me. Thanks.